I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. It's my understanding that the attorneys have checked in for both cases that are on our docket this morning for 9 o'clock. We have another case at 10:30 that will also be argued. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left is Judge Mark Wallach, who's visiting by assignment, and I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. Before we begin with the first case, I'd ask the clerk to please call the case.
The court will now call Iran Spivey versus the state of Texas. The mayor, please, the court, Mr. Jack Strickland to argue for the appellant, and Speaker Baker to argue for the state.
You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Jack Strickland from Fort Worth. And I have a couple of housekeeping details that I would first like to address. First, I'd like to thank the court for honoring and granting my request for oral argument here this morning. Mr. Spivey's family is here, and it's extremely important that they have this opportunity to hear oral argument, and we appreciate it very much. Secondly, and I say this only so that it won't be claimed that I ignored a concern of the defendant or the appellant in this case, There was apparently some misunderstanding in regard to State's Exhibit Number 19, which was admitted without objection. I should note there's a question that arose as to whether or not that came from the bedroom or the bathroom. I think it's immaterial, but I nonetheless assured the appellant that I would bring it to the attention of the court this morning. This is an appeal from the 297th District Court here in Fort Worth. Wherein the appellant was charged and found guilty of the offense of capital murder of a child under the age of 10. The death penalty had been waived in this case, so of course upon the finding of guilt, he was sentenced to life without parole in the Texas Department of Corrections, where he remains till this day. I would like, if it's permissible this morning, to limit my remarks in the short time I have available to point of error number one, which I believe is number one because I think it's the most significant of the points that we have asked the court to consider here. I'm going to, with no disrespect to anyone, certainly not the prosecutors in the case, and certainly not even the Grand Prairie Police Department, to entitled point of error number one essentially is "Don't confuse me with the facts." Our minds, that is, the minds of the police officers that investigated the case. Our minds are made up. And I say that because of the decision apparently made by the Grand Prairie Police Department to not meaningfully investigate the behavior of the natural mother of this child. She was not charged with any offense whatsoever in this case. And in a moment, although I know you've read the briefs, in a moment I will explain why I believe that that is so significant to the determination of this case. And recognize the absolutely impossible position that the appellant was put into by the failure of the Grand Prairie Police Department and its investigation. The injuries to this child are horrendous. Even for those of us that have spent time, as I know that you all have, certainly that I have had and the prosecutors have had, dealing with instances of abuse to children, this one is extraordinary in its scope and its brutality. I have listed in the brief 31 separate findings that were made by and testified to the medical examiner who conducted the post-mortem examination upon this child. They range from seriously minor, if there's something that can be called that, simply by comparison to the most serious of the offenses. We have bruises, we have contusions. They're all over every part of the child's body. Then we ranged and go to the more major of the injuries that had been inflicted upon this two-year-old child. Bleeding into the lungs, a broken wrist, damage to the pancreas, scarring on the inside of the skull that was in the process of healing, as was the left wrist, and the fatal injury, which was a skull fracture, which was serious and fatal. The likelihood is that given the nature of that injury, had a medical doctor been present at the time that injury was inflicted, the child was probably not going to survive. The appellant in this case was the boyfriend of the natural mother of the child. And according to the testimony, she left for work that morning about 7:30. They had been awakened with the child throwing up in the bed, which was not unusual. But rather than stay home and care for the child, she simply left. I think it's important to note that she did not check in, inquire as to the condition of the child any time during the day, but came back to the house and without notifying, the defendant simply went to bed. That injury was inflicted by someone since the earlier evening, because there's a videotape that I know that you've recognized in the brief. That injury was not inflicted upon the child the prior evening when they were in a laundromat, but it was inflicted on the child sometime thereafter. The Grand Prairie Police Department chose to charge the defendant, who had no criminal history, who had never been in trouble with the law, and had only lived with the mother and the child for approximately 1 month. The nature of the injuries indicates that some of the injuries, certainly not the fatal skull fracture, but some of the injuries, if not all of the injuries, had been inflicted sometime prior to that day and were in the process of healing, which indicates some lifespan of more than just a couple of hours. Now, there are three possibilities that I would invite the court to consider as to the culpability of the mother in this case. Either she was the one who inflicted the injuries, or she, in conjunction with another person, inflicted the injuries. Or the third possibility is not a crime of commission, but is a crime of omission, that she was aware that in the past there had been injuries inflicted upon the child, had not chosen to treat those injuries, simply ignored them. Some of them were recent, as is evidenced by the fact that the bruising was starting to turn colors, that some of the contusions were starting to scab over, and of course that some of the injuries were in the process of healing, as we've already noted, such as the wrist, such as the pancreas, and the internal scarring, not fresh wounds, but scarring inside the skull of the child. So those three possibilities would lead one to at least question, it seems to me, when those injuries were inflicted and what the role of the mother was. Those injuries and that evidence were of sufficient significance to Judge Hagerman, who's the presiding judge of the 297th, to, on his own, actually appoint counsel to represent, in the event it should become necessary, the mother of this child. There's no record that counsel took any actions, ever did anything on the record in the presence of the jury or outside the presence of the jury. But nonetheless, after just a very little bit of testimony, Judge Hagerman decided that it was very important to have counsel for this woman based on what he had heard up to that point.
While there might have been evidence that there was prior abuse, none of that abuse caused the death of this child.
That's exactly correct. That is exactly correct. So we're not arguing about the fact that that's the direct cause of the death. But it is important because it demonstrates, I believe, some abusive conduct or ignorance of abusive conduct by the mother prior to the time of the infliction of the death. And the reason that I believe this is important is for this reason. By failing to charge this woman with either a crime of commission or omission, they effectively immunized her from any sort of cross-examination, any opportunity to rebut what her contention was, because only she and the defendant were in that home with that child that morning.
But isn't the undisputed evidence that the child was standing, talking, kissed his mother goodbye immediately prior to her departure?
It was undisputed because there was only one other witness to that, and that is Mr. Spivey, the appellant in this case. He was placed on the horns of a dilemma.
Didn't he agree with that in his initial interview with the police?
He did agree with that. But the interview that he had with the police pales in comparison to the significance of her being able to get on the stand and give this testimony and he not being able to rebut it in any fashion. There were only two witnesses, two adult witnesses, in regard to what occurred in the apartment that morning after they'd gotten home from the laundromat and before the child's mother left for work at about 7:30 in the morning. He would have to give up his constitutional right to remain silent. It was Sophie's choice, or the horns of a dilemma, or however you wish to characterize it. If he wished to rebut in any substantive way the testimony of the mother.
But isn't that same dilemma playing out in hundreds, if not thousands, of courtrooms across this country right at this very moment?
I don't know that there are thousands at this very moment, but I certainly recognize and agree with the fact that that is not an infrequent occurrence, that you're placed in that position where you only have those two witnesses. But given the nature of the evidence that would justify the police filing a charge on this woman, the truth of the matter is, we're all experienced trial lawyers, we know what the circumstances would then lead to. She would not have testified. She would have had to, in all likelihood, ignore the advice of her appointed counsel, take the stand anyway, and subject herself to cross-examination at that point. That's the consequence, and that's not the consequence that happens, I would suggest, in the majority of cases in this country, and I also suggest not in the majority of significant cases in this country. Next to the death penalty being imposed, this is the most serious judgment that can be rendered against a criminal defendant.
Do you have any case that says that such a situation is impermissible in the law?
Well, the courts, the state court and federal court, the United States Supreme Court, have recognized that if a defendant is deprived of the opportunity to have a fair trial, that can rise to a level of a...
But I'm talking about these particular circumstances where they didn't charge the mother or they didn't charge the only other witness to relevant proof.
No, Your Honor, and I would suggest that the reason we don't have any such cases is that with the facts presented by this case, the overwhelming likelihood is, that the mother would likewise have been charged because of the nature and the frequency and the long passage of time from the infliction of prior injuries when the appellant was not even in the picture up to the present time. There was plenty of evidence to charge this woman with at least a crime of omission, if not an actual commission. Plenty of opportunity. And the Supreme Court of the United States has recognized that not in every circumstance, certainly, but in some circumstances, the denial of a fair trial can be a constitutional violation. And that's what we rely on. This man was not afforded a fair trial because he couldn't. He couldn't take the stand, either because he had knowledge about the mother, or because he had conspired with the mother, or he'd interacted with the mother, or because he was guilty. I'm not suggesting that possibility doesn't have to enter into it. But what it does is his counsel and the appellant had absolutely no opportunity to question the mother in some meaningful way and bring to the jury's attention the fact that either she couldn't testify or refused to testify because criminal charges were lodged and pending against her at the time. There's no opportunity whatsoever. The mother, to compound that, on the very day that the child died, had no interest, not the slightest bit of interest, in either staying home with the child, caring for the child, taking the child to the doctor. She didn't even notify the appellant when she got off work early that day, after having not even made a phone call during the course of the day to see how the child was doing. Simply coming back to the apartment and without notifying him, going to bed and sleeping through the remainder of the day as her child was dying. In this particular case, the appellant is the only one who sought any medical attention for the child. He's the only one that described in detail where he was and what he did that day. He did not invoke his right to remain silent during the police interrogation. He didn't drop the child off at the front door of the first medical facility that the child was taken to. And he actually went back by the house, which I think was ill-advised, to see if the mother had come home and to get her to go with him to the hospital where the child was pronounced dead. Clearly, I believe that this appellant had something to do with the death of the child. But he wasn't the only one that had anything to do with the death of the child. And so all of the attention of not only the police and the prosecution, but the jurors were focused on him, and not much he could do about it. We believe that that was a due process violation that rendered it impossible for him to have, and in fact, did not have, a fair trial. And we would ask that the judgment in this case be reversed.
Thank you.
It pleases the court, counsel. My name is Stephen Baker, represent the state. I kind of want to start with something that the appellant left off with. He applied if he didn't at least explicitly argue that the appellant was the only one who did anything for that child that day. He talks about how the mother left and went to her work to get her homework. The child, as actually appellant mentioned, had thrown up because of a health problems the child had been suffering from since he was a younger child. It was not out of the ordinary for that sort of thing to happen. But the reason the mother didn't call or think to call or check in on the child was because when she left the child at home, he was standing and he was talking. In fact, she kissed him goodbye and she told him she loved him. Then he kissed her goodbye and he was standing in the hallway on his own. She had no reason to think that anything had gone up with the child. Additionally, there was no evidence at trial that supports appellant's argument that the child's mother is guilty of murder. Appellant argues that the mother's continuous abuse or failure to report such abuse resulted in the child's death. However, Dr. Candace Shope, who performed the autopsy on the child in this case, said the child's older injuries to the pancreas, liver, adrenal gland did not contribute to the child's death. And this also includes, I think, appellant mentioned in his argument, a broken wrist. And I believe her testimony also was that broken wrist was something that sometimes does happen to children that maybe sometimes parents don't notice. As strange as that sounds, that would be maybe something that the mother had not noticed. But regardless, as Justice Gabriel pointed out, none of these injuries led to this child's, none of those older injuries led to this child's death in this case. The child's death was caused by multiple blunt force injuries to the child's head. The child suffered injuries to his left side, left hip, side thigh, and left side of his chest. Dr. Schoep believed these were contemporaneous with the head injuries and most likely were caused by maybe punching the child. Or that's possible. Obviously, the doctor wasn't there, but that was her theory. The child's head was stroked multiple times. There were bruises to the scalp. Those type of bruises don't typically happen unless there's blunt force injury occurred. The child had a large skull fracture. He was bleeding inside his skull. The fracture occurred at the back part of the skull, which takes much more force than, say, when you fall down and trip and maybe bump your head, although skull fractures can occur in situations like that, but that wasn't the case here. This type of injury doesn't happen by accident again. The injury was consistent with a moving head striking a fixed object. Dr. Shope's testimony also was that when an injury like this happens, the child will most likely be unconscious. But if the child isn't unconscious, the caregiver is going to know that something is very wrong in that moment. Appellant also pointed out in his argument that the state's failure to charge the mother in this case with a crime somehow affected his ability to cross-examine her. I think the record reflects that the appellant had every ability and was allowed to cross-examine not only the mother when she testified, but was also able to cross-examine Dr. Shope about the child's older injuries and the ones that were closer to, or the head injuries that actually caused the child's death. In addition to what I've already said, I think the evidence shows that the following reasons are why the mother was not charged in this case. The day before the child was murdered, the child showed no signs of severe head trauma, like I mentioned earlier. When the mother left for work that morning at about 8 a.m. or 7:30, I believe the appellant said, somewhere around there, the child was walking around, appeared to be behaving normally. The appellant said he gave the child a bath. Police later found a towel in the apartment near the air mattress, not in the bathroom, that tested positive for blood that matched the child's DNA profile. Blood that matched the child's DNA profile was found on the air mattress in the apartment's bedroom. Between the time his mother left the apartment and the appellant arrived at Dollar General, that's the store the child first went to with the appellant on the appellant's way to work, appellant was alone with the child. When appellant arrived with the child at Dollar General, the child was limp and lifeless, as it's shown in State's Exhibit Number 63. At the Dollar General, appellant purchased a nasal aspirator to suction the blood that was coming out of the child's nose. Blood collected from the nasal aspirator tested positive for blood that matched the DNA profile for the child. Tissues and washcloth found in appellant's car matched the DNA profile for the child. From approximately 9:26 a.m. to 5:55 p.m. on December 7th, appellant worked at his job at Home Zone while the child bled to death because of a skull fracture and internal bleeding. There was a pillow in the appellant's break room that tested positive for the child's blood. A cutting from the mattress the child was laying on the store had bloody spots. Bloody washcloth and tissues were found in appellant's car. Blood that matched the child's DNA profile was found on the comforter that was collected from appellant's work break room floor. The state may prove a defendant's identity as the murderer by circumstantial evidence, which alone can be sufficient. Here the jury was entitled to believe, based on the mother's testimony, that the child was left in appellant's care in a healthy condition. Appellant was the only person in possession of the child when he sustained the injuries that eventually led to his death. The evidence did not give rise to the inference that someone other than appellant committed this murder. I believe with that, the state has covered not only appellant's first point of error, but a second point of error as well. Do the justices have any questions for the state? Then the state will return its time to the court.
Thank you.
Please, the court. I know that the verdict has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the jury's decision and to the guilty finding in this case. But that requirement does not extend to the point that the remainder of the evidence should simply be ignored in reaching this determination of favorability. Very quickly, bruises on the chest, bruises on the mid-abdomen, bruises on the upper abdomen, bruises on the upper thighs, swelling of the forehead, multiple contusions to the face, multiple scrapes to the left side of the eye, bruising to the eyelid itself, contusions and scrapes to the right side of the face, contusions on the lower arm, contusions on the upper right arm, contusions to his right hip, bruises and scrapes to the back, scrapes on his shoulder blade, bruises to upper left leg, scrapes on his nose, bruises and scrapes to his right ear, bruises and scrapes to the lip, bruises to the scalp, bruises to the back of the head, multiple impact sites under the scalp, scarring inside the skull, indications of blunt force trauma to the head, a torn liver, hemorrhaging and bleeding in the mesentery, hemorrhaging in the retroperitoneal tissues, injury to the right adrenal gland, injury to the pancreas, bleeding into both lungs, scarring of the liver, and a broken left wrist. Let's just say for a moment that the mother, when she came home that day, that the child had not suffered either before she left or by her own actions, but let's just give her the benefit of the doubt. If she had come home and said, you know, he just doesn't look right, and let's take out the fatal injury, the damage to the skull, and she had taken that child with those symptoms that were discovered medically after the child's death, disregarding the skull fracture, and presented that child to people at the emergency room, how long would it have taken for somebody, a capable medical practitioner, to have said, oh my God, get the police down here, toot sweet. This demonstrates a pattern of abuse, some relatively minor, some extraordinarily.
But wasn't your client given full opportunity to cross-examine her about these very issues at trial? And isn't that really what the law provides for as far as the rights to the accused? Is the opportunity to cross-examine and confront these?
Absolutely he was, Judge, except for the most crucial of the questions. Have you been charged either for a crime of commission of these injuries to this child or for a crime of omission arising under your parental responsibility to care for the child?
But isn't that irrelevant? Because
no,
a charge is a mere accusation.
Pardon, Judge?
A charge is a mere accusation.
It is still...
It's not evidence of guilt.
It is not evidence of guilt, but it certainly is evidence that the district attorney's office and the police department believe that she had some culpability as opposed to giving her a free pass. That's the most crucial of the question. And that
is
question,
it your position that any time that a possible co-defendant, accomplice, is not charged, then the one who does get charged doesn't get a fair trial? Because that seems to me to be what you're saying.
No, Judge. I respectfully disagree with that. And if I am saying it, I'm not stating my position very well. Given the nature of these injuries, the multiplicity of these injuries, and the age that is evident in some of these injuries, scarring inside, not bleeding inside the skull, although I'm sure there was some of that, scarring inside the skull, wounds to the skull that were healing and they were inside the skull.
But the jury had the opportunity to hear this.
They did.
And they rejected it.
Would they have rejected it had she been appropriately charged? Number one, I doubt she would have testified.
So you're saying that your client had the right not to cross-examine her. Your client had the right for this other witness, the mother, to plead the fifth in front of the jury, to invoke the right to Fifth Amendment privilege in front of the jury. That's the right that you think your client's been deprived of.
Plead the fifth in front of the jury?
All right. To refuse to answer the questions. She would refuse to answer the questions if she'd been charged.
But not in front of the jury. She can't take the fifth in the presence of the jury. She would simply, through her court-appointed counsel, said, I'm not going to testify in this case. I'm going to invoke my right to silence in this case.
Well, that's what I mean.
Been charged.
Okay. So she, you're saying your client is entitled for her not to testify. That's my point.
He's advantaged by her not testifying, by her invoking her right, because she's likewise been charged. As I said, there's only three possibilities for the mom. She did it, she helped the defendant do it, or she did neither of those, but over a long period of time, she, to the exclusion of anybody else's name ever arose in this, she, to the exclusion of anybody else in the world, inflicted this horrible list of injuries upon this child.
Thank you.
And due process requires the opportunity for him to explore that without the necessity of giving up his own constitutional right to remain silent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, we thank you for your argument. Your case has been submitted, and you are free to leave, or you may stay and listen to the next argument. It's up to you.
Okay,